Hey y'all, welcome. This is White Homework. I am Tori. I'm super excited. Today we have Benjamin Fay on the show. We are going to be talking about grit and resilience and the ways that culturally we are expected to constantly have grit and resilience, but we're never allowed to have rest. And talking about the impacts of that for folks of color, kind of specifically, but it impacts all of us. If you're someone with a body and a nervous system, you've certainly felt the impacts of being expected to have grit and resilience when we have the ability to make systems work better, to make systems that work for everyone. So we do a pretty deep dive. It's a little bit of a meandering conversation, but it's also good. Benji's incredible. Super excited for you to listen. All right. Benji, thank you so much for coming on White Homework. Really appreciate it. Wanted to talk to you about, you know, some cultural things that might be impacting people, people of color, people doing activism work, poor people, mm-hmm. disabled people, all of the people, right? Mm-hmm. I really wanted to have a discussion with you about grit and resilience and how I think that, like, culturally we kind of over rely on grit and resilience mm-hmm. when they're not actually inexhaustible resources, and we can't demand those things from people forever without giving them a break.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess, first of all, like, how would you, in your life, like, what is like grit, resilience look like in terms of the expectation that's on us to, like, stay regulated regardless of, like, what the police state and capitalism are doing to us?
Oh,
small questions.
Right.
You know how I go.
I think because of the ways in which I show up in the world and the ways in which I have identities in the world, the concepts of grit and resilience are incredibly subjective ones. I am not only a Black man, I am a Black man with dreadlocks, which I know in some places might not be very, very common. However, I live in the South, you know, throw a rock in any direction, you'll hit six of us. So, you know, so I'm Black, I have dreadlocks, I have ADHD, diagnosed ADHD. I was diagnosed almost 25 years ago.
Okay.
Which was super progressive at the time for a Black child to be diagnosed with ADHD back then.
Yes, that is objectively a true statement.
Right. Then again, I grew up in the suburbs, so it wasn't, okay. You know, it was more likely that I would be diagnosed there than in the city of Philadelphia necessarily. You know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. All of those things show up, and it kind of requires grit and resilience to get through them, because the world is not designed for any of the ways in which I show up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, just getting up some mornings, you know, it's just kind of an act of defiance. You know, getting up in the morning sometimes is not only just an act of defiance, but it's a big, you know, middle finger to all my negative emotions, and getting up with a smile too,
mm-hmm.
you know, is kind of an affront to all those things. And, you know, possibly the Department of Justice, because I imagine they want to see me enslaved rather than see me successful. And that's just how the numbers break down. That's not just a personal opinion. For me, grit and resilience don't look the way in which they are commonly portrayed. Having been a child that grew up in the 90s, grit is, you know, it's a Chevy commercial.
Yeah.
It's trucks driving slow motion in the mud while Bob Seger plays in the background. It's what's loosely insinuated by, you know, Bob the Builder, can you fix it? It's all of those things. There's a lot of machismo that is attached to grit and resilience. Yeah. And I grew up in a football town, so it's like, you know, the gridiron, and, you know, there's all these loose associations mm-hmm. that don't actually have any grounding in reality. I think the greatest grit and resilience comes from people who exist in the margins, who didn't ask to exist in the margins but have to, whether by way of, you know, cultural identity, gender identity, or disability. I think those are the people I learned the most about grit and resilience from, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Same. It's a lot, I would say. when we're talking about, like, grit being kind of, there's, like, a part of it that's like this sort of, I don't even say toxic masculinity. I don't think it's inherently toxic, right? In mm-hmm. in the construct of masculinity. I don't think grit is inherently toxic. I think the self-reliance, fuck you, I'm going to get mine, that's toxic, but that's also not grit, right? Like that's a right. lie that we sort of perpetuate. And so like within that context, for people who are doing activism work, for people of color, disabled mm-hmm. folks, anybody who exists like on any of the margins where we don't receive support, which is, you know, most of the demographics, I would say, right. in this country.
Right.
What kind of dangers do you see resulting from like the societal narrative, I guess, that grit and resilience are just these inexhaustible resources and people on the margin just need to like, come on, buddy, you can do it. Like, buck up. That kind of nonsense, right? Because like what I'm observing is I think that it's been kind of been turned into like this therapy-esque term.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, you just got to have grit. And it's like, okay, but you're telling me to like fold in the cheese. What does that mean?
Oh my God. Like people talk about grit like it's something you can go to Walgreens and be like, yeah, where do you have grit? Yeah, it's aisle five. You know, like just pull it off the wall. And we've always talked about it. And it's just like, okay, where do I find this
uh-huh.
grit that you speak of? And uh-huh. they're just kind of like, you just kind of do it. And it's like the least helpful thing in the world. And I think that's where a lot of the harm is the presumption mm-hmm. that it's just this thing that we can just pull on. I think the narrative surrounding grit kind of holds hands with the narrative surrounding laziness where it pertains to people of color.
Yep.
Because I didn't realize I had grit or resilience until I realized that I wasn't lazy. And that was only a handful of years ago. Like laziness was always a part of the narrative for me, especially as a neurodivergent person around a lot of neurotypical people who were just like, well, just do it. You know, just get up, just be organized, you know, just have a planner. And I'm like, I would have a planner if I remember where I put it.
Yeah.
And I absolutely. Know that if I buy another one, I'm going to forget where I put that one. So it's like, I'm going to save myself the money and the humiliation, the latter of which is the bigger deal to me at that point. And that's just neurodivergence. We're not even talking about being like Black in America. The expectation is grit. There's a reason why when you see a lot of Black-centric movies in Hollywood, it's always surrounding, you know, civil rights. And it's never just, you know, Black human rom-com. We got to go to BET mm-hmm. Plus for that stuff. Is because they see Black people as synonymous with struggle,
yeah.
but not in a way in where anyone feels incentivized to alleviate that struggle.
Yep.
It's just like, this is what you do. It's as if like white people expect... But like their engagement with racism is to acknowledge that Black people struggle and not that they have a part in making sure that Black people don't have to struggle.
Yeah.
So it's largely narrative driven, I think, is the harm. It's the idea that, you know, this is just baseline for you. Like your lot in life is to be Sisyphus without realizing that they are also the rock.
Yeah.
So it's this weird thing, you know, that exists. You know, it's like you've always had grit. Your ancestors have had grit. So that's who you should be. It's like the desire of my ancestors was not that I would work as hard as them. I mean, if you want to talk about it, my desires of my ancestors was the 40 acres and a mule that you said you were going to give but didn't. The desire of my ancestors was delivering on promises that in general, I mean, you could talk about that in a million different ways. You could talk about the GI Bill. You could talk about everything that Dr. King actually talked about in the I Have a Dream speech.
Mm-hmm.
I have a real bone to pick with that. When people talk about, pick apart the not by the character, but the color of the skin thing. And mm-hmm. it's like, that was like three-fourths of the way down. What he spent most of the time talking about was the fact that America made a bunch of promises to Black people and never delivered on any of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like the harm comes from this confluence of people of color wanting and knowing they're meant for more and a narrative that is built on you belong with less because inherently we think you are less. Like they only just figured out that Black people feel pain in a medical sense, like what, not terribly long ago. And even the NFL gave like the way they allotted money for concussions was different based on whether the player was Black or not.
Yeah.
Which is wild in a league that is 70% Black.
Yeah.
So that means you're underpaying most of the people that leave. So it's just I don't know if this directly answers your question, because I think I kind of answered a million things around the question. But really, I feel like the harm is based in how we see each other, which is really a narrative-based struggle. And then the narrative then informs the everyday realities, and they have for centuries.
Yeah, completely, completely agree. It's an interesting time, I would say, trying to navigate all of that and yeah. navigate like the narratives, the expectations of like the, yeah, this is just sort of your lot in life. And like you struggle and you have resilience and that's just like your story. And that's what makes you special. It's like, please, I don't want you have to have resilience. You know, I would love to be just a productive, happy, tax-paying right. member of society. I would love to not need to have grit to like go to the grocery store.
Right.
But it's no one's responsibility to change right. that, which is interesting.
One of the darkest questions that has ever been asked humanity is, what is your dream job? Y'all really dream of labor, huh? That's where y'all's head is at? When I woke up on Saturday, you know, I was like, oh, I don't actually have to do anything. I can make choices about where I go. If I could just do this for 6 more days, you know, and then 7 more days after that, I might be able to string together a nice little life here. You know, like my dream is not labor. My dream is enjoyment. You know, the line between living and existing really isn't that fine, but at least not to me anyway. But because we've been so inundated with the concept of grind culture and, you know, hustle culture, however, whatever terms you want to ascribe to that,
yeah.
that kind of glorifies the 9-to-5 and glorifies the having no time for yourself. The more we normalize that, the more that line gets very, very blurry, even though it's a very, very clear line. If everybody has to be resilient, is the system working? You know, it's kind of like, so as a formerly unhoused person, you know, I've sat in rooms where people have, you know, people who've been housed their whole lives have all these great suggestions about how things should work, about, you know, building shelters in these places. It's like, okay, at a certain point, you have to ask yourself, is the solution more shelters or more housing? In a similar way, it's like, what does it say about society if everybody has to go to therapy? What does it say about the way the system is functioning if everybody has to grind to make the simplest thing work? At what point do we zoom out and say, maybe this is indicative of something that isn't so great? I'll give you an example. I was in Target the other day. And I don't know if you've been in Target in the last 5 to 6 months, but you might start to see more and more things exist behind lockboxes, specifically socks and undergarments and things. I saw somebody posting about baby formula that was behind lockboxes.
That's the first one to go usually.
Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, in an establishment that sells PS5s and TVs, folks are selling baby, people are stealing baby formula and socks. At what point does that become informational?
Yeah.
At what point is that like a data point where we're like, huh, what it sounds like is these things are inaccessible. What do we do to make these things accessible? To which everyone responds, have you considered trying harder? And around we go.
Capitalism is so fascinating, right? Because we get this information and they do not care. They not do all. Not care. And then it's like, if something gets really bad, right? Like during the protests, for example, oh, we have to close down this location. It's your fault. You should stop stealing and breaking windows. And, or Target, which better than nothing, I will say, they're like, oh, we're going to have more like Black-owned brands like stocked on our shelves. I think that's a good thing on right. like in the net.
Right. Objectively, sure.
You know, at the same time, what, you know, it's like, and they do this thing where it's like, we give back 5% to our community. And it's like, but like you said, people are stealing socks and underwear and baby formula. So where's that money going? Because I know that those things don't account for a whole 5% of what you bring in a month.
They sure don't. They sure don't. I mean, yeah. I mean, because ultimately, like, there aren't many problems in America that you can't trace back to capitalism in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah,
like
totally.
Atlanta, like so Georgia's state minimum wage is $7.25.
Right.
Which is very, very, very common in the South. Because the South has a very large Black population. And there's a lot of reasons for that that probably go back to the transatlantic slave trade and things of that nature.
Yep.
But they generally don't like to pay people down here. Like very recently, Mississippi refused government money because they didn't want quote unquote liberal handouts. So that's a direct quote. They don't want liberal handouts.
Which isn't true because you're like a net negative on the balance book. So
I'm like, if you
try
look at
again,
the 10 most federally dependent states in the country, like 8 of them are red states.
Yeah.
And I say red loosely because
they're
a lot
gerrymandered.
Of those states are full of Black and queer people.
Yeah.
Right. Like Atlanta is one of the Blackest and queerest cities you will ever go to in your life. But it's right in, it's a blue dot in the middle of like, you know, an objectively like red sea. Like
right.
Marjorie Taylor Greene is a representative in this state somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's so funny how you were saying like how the answer stares people right in the face. Like it's very obvious that the capitalism experiment is not working. The one that leads to people stealing these things from Target. The one that leads to these to people needing to have grit and determination, because I know that if I start doling out numbers about what the average rent is in the United States, you know, against what the average pay is in the United States, somebody's gonna be like, well, why don't you just get another job? Why don't you get a roommate? Why don't you blah, 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 blah. And that's before we even enter into the pandemic element of all these things,
yeah,
you know, which yeah. greatly harms the idea of like, going out to get a roommate because it's like safety, not just in the present sense, but also where do you align politically?
Mm-hmm.
Like, because I need to know, like, because that has real ramifications in my house. Like, what
right.
are all these things? And so, like, as you peel it back and you look at all these things, it's so obvious what needs to be done. But because of how it works against the concept of the American dream,
mm-hmm.
like, America has never met a thing it cannot monetize or market.
Yeah.
So, the thing that keeps people coming to America to find that land of opportunity, that's all branding. It's all a marketing ploy.
It's a marketing scheme, yeah.
And it's all existed for so long, you know, like.
This is my favorite thing to respond, that I see people respond with, like, to conservatives online who are like, well, if America sucks so bad, why are so many people coming here? And it's like, because we have great marketing. That is why.
Well, A, we have great marketing and we're probably overthrowing their government.
So mm-hmm. Yeah,
depending on where it is.
Trickle down warfare and great
exactly,
marketing.
Exactly. It's two extremes of the same imperialism.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But ultimately, we have great marketing. Like, I was able to pull that Chevy Trucks thing out of my ass. I haven't seen one. Like, I think I saw a Chevy Trucks commercial like online for the first time in like 30 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, where mm-hmm. where it was like that kind of like, get in the soil, like, you know, like loose right wing populism.
Yes.
Of like, you know, like Joe Everyday, who actually lives in Preston, Idaho, who like wakes up at like 6 o'clock in the morning to like, you know, or earlier to tend to the animals. And, you know, just the iconography of just
yes.
the hard worker.
Yes.
Uh-huh. When we talk about grit and resilience, it's usually a white man in Carhartt.
Yes.
And like a white man in Carhartt overalls named Joe, not like a white man with a Carhartt beanie doing yoga named Bodhi. Like, I'm not like there's a clear association that they're trying to draw when they say grit and resilience.
Yes.
And what we don't want to talk about is how white centered that conversation is,
mm-hmm.
because they'll call it grit and resilience when it's, you know, Joe Schmo from Idaho. But when Colin Kaepernick took a seat, now he's a troublemaker. I bet they said the same thing about Dr. King. Like, Dr. King was hated.
Yeah.
You'll call him resilient now, but that's because you have time and distance. He was like the most hated man in America in 1968.
Yeah.
The thing about this topic is that there's so many layers to it.
Yeah.
As there are whenever you're dealing with any essence of Americana.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In particular, it's this idea that the people you want to do all the work for you are the ones who you think need grit and resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And that you are the person who is going to teach it to them, which is why I get so mad when I see like financial literacy in the hood. Like, the hood don't need financial literacy. The hood need finances.
No, you're right. There are so many different layers to, I think, the narrative around grit, the expectation, the racialized expectations around grit, right? Because mm-hmm. it's like, I don't know. I'm sure for you and for me, like if you're looking at a photo from, I don't know, like 1910 or 1930 or something, mm-hmm. looking at like it's of sharecroppers in a cotton field. To me, yeah. I'm like, that's fucking hard work.
Yeah.
You know? And I guess like through a white lens, it's like, oh, I bet they weren't working very hard. The rules are more important than surviving.
Right.
And so doing things the right way. And I, like, for me, the thing that stands out really, really hard, because, you know, whatever, the pilgrims, they're showing up, they're freezing to death. Meanwhile, there's all of these little Indians running around buck naked in the middle of January. And it's like, shouldn't you just ask them, like, hey, what are you doing to keep warm? But it's like, no, bodies are shameful. They need to be covered. And so we have to be wearing these clothes that are freezing to our skin, trapping in all this moisture. And then we're going to die. And everybody's going to experience more trauma because of that. And it's like, the rules were so important. Like, the rules are more important than staying alive. And it wasn't like the rules of, you know, don't start fights, don't steal. It's like the rules of like etiquette. Mm-hmm. are worth dying for. Like, the number of white people who have died for etiquette in the attempt at like colonizing the whole planet is wild if you start paying attention to it.
It's like, I wonder how many black and brown people have died because white folks expected police to do the right thing. There are some weapons in existence that haven't killed more people than benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, that's a narrative thing too, this idea that, you know, decorum above all else. Like, for example, I was just at a protest, you know, and as we're talking about like things like the Aaron Bushnell situation, and, you know, there's a lot of different ideas about that. And it's like, we get to a point where we have more conversations about the manner of protest than what the protest was regarding. I agree with protest, but not that way. I'm like, okay, well, what way? Mm-hmm. Or if we want to really get granular with it, what about the other things? What about the other methods of protest that existed before this that did not work? But because you care so much about the right way, why is it that the harmed party is always expected to do things the right way, but those who have done the harm are given no such instructions or expectations whatsoever? They just get to get off scot-free.
Right.
It is always been a thing that bothers me. The people who are disenfranchised in any given situation are supposed to be the ones who uphold the structure that is harming them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can parse that in any real direction. But to your point, what has that gotten them? Like, what has being a rule follower actually profited you? Or better yet, what has it profited the people around you? You know, we're seeing, even with this coming election, we're seeing a lot of conversations about, you know, we'll get him at the ballot box, we'll get him here. I'm like, you do realize the ballot box has been taken away from people several times, and not just recent history, but just over the course of the American experiment. I'm fairly certain the U.S. is the only country in existence to have anti-literacy laws on its books at any point. There may be a few others, but I'm pretty sure the United States is the only one. It was a part of the rules,
right,
that some of us couldn't learn.
Yes.
And that still kind of exists. When I was doing public speaking and I would go to places dressed nicely and talking, you know, I remember walking up to a woman and people, and they're like, they'll always be like, you're so articulate and you're so well-spoken. And mind you, generally speaking, that's a nice compliment to get.
Right.
But it's always coming from older white folks. And I always have to parse it in my mind. I'm like, what y'all mean by that?
Yeah.
What do you mean by well-spoken? Like, to a point that it confuses you? Like, because if it confuses you, that's a tacit acknowledgement that, you know, there's an inequality somewhere. You to a point of expectation, to where if I can put two sentences together I have defied your expectation, which means your bar for me was in hell. But then watch, because then I'm the one they use and tokenize and send out there as an example of grit and resilience.
Yep.
It's like, it's like, where did you learn to do that? I'm like, school. Like, where do you think I learned it? Maybe for some generations it was like the internet, but I'm like, yo, YouTube wasn't a thing until I was 18 years old. Yeah. So like, look, I am a child that went to the library, and you know, there's all these kind of tacit expectations that exist around the idea of grit and resilience. And I imagine it's what is being said of people like Byron Donalds or Tim Scott or Candace Owens or anyone in that ilk who defied the odds, one of the good blacks, because they worked hard per the parameters of what we think working hard is.
What you said about the benefit of the doubt, right? Mm-hmm. Is it's just sort of like automatically given. And all of us, regardless of how we were raised or like where we grew up in this country, you know, we were all coded from a young age to give little white boys the benefit of the doubt, right? Because we were told their stories. Yeah. And we were like, look at all of these emotional experiences that they're having and how hard it is for them. And it's like, okay, we're talking about, I don't know, like Catcher in the Rye. We're talking about a kid who went to like boarding school. It's like, oh, poor you. Like, you're really discovering how hard the world is because like you can't get laid. Okay.
You could make the same argument about Gatsby too. We had to read that too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. For me, I'm like, okay, we already know how to empathize with white men.
Right.
And they continue to train us to give white men the benefit of the doubt. Cops are another really cute example of like, well, he had good intentions. He was there to prevent. Yeah, exactly. He was there to like prevent violence, but he was concerned that someone was going to get shot. Someone was going to get stabbed. He was concerned that somebody was going to like touch him, you know, like it's all of the things. Right. So we're kind of given it's fascinating because it's like you're given the benefit of the doubt. And so that means that like you're less grit is expected of you.
Right.
Like you are not expected to be resilient in the face of getting a call that someone is having a mental health crisis.
Right.
You're expected to be the authority. Those aren't the same thing.
Exactly. And that's a conversation on the flip side of that. That's a conversation about regulation.
Yes.
Because the person on the far side has to have better regulation skills, you know, than the authority figure. And
legally,
that is...
legally has to have better regulation than the authority figure. Like according to the fucking law.
For a while, I was a social emotional learning coach for 7th and 8th grade kids at a school in South Atlanta.
Okay.
And so regulation is something that is very near and dear to me as a topic because I see what happens when dysregulation occurs. A lot of the things that people feel like need to be met with punitive measures are a matter of one or two people, you know, being dysregulated, and one of them has a developed frontal lobe. And so I saw a lot of times, so there was one time where students were like, you know, getting rambunctious and throwing paper and stuff. And generally speaking, I understand that classes need to happen, but that's what I expect from 13-year-old boys and 14-year-old boys who aren't guaranteed PE, which is not guaranteed, especially in middle schools. You know, it might be something you have once a quarter or like once a marking period, but then you switch.
Right.
You know, and that was the case for me. And I went to middle school 25 years ago, you know, so it's the same thing now. And I remember there was one teacher who just looked like they did not want to be there. It's an oddity where it's like people who are not people commonly find themselves in jobs where they have to interface with people. And this was one of those moments where they were doing something and they clearly defied the teacher and ran off running and were doing something. And they just look at me kind of defeated and were like, you know, with as easy as it is to train animals, you'd think it'd be easy to train children. And I couldn't say anything in that moment because I needed to regulate.
Yes.
Because the rage, of course, you're not going to have the same experience with a child that you would with an animal because they're fucking animals. You are talking about a human, a young human. And because you've bought into the hierarchy of your authority more than you've bought into their humanity. If you say some rude stuff to them, and some teachers say really rude things to kids, and they can get away with it because if the kid says something back, boom, punitive measure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now they have to figure out ways to regulate themselves with no training.
Yeah.
Like, their voices are changing and you expect them to handle their emotions? Like, everything about their existence is kind of coming apart and coming together, and they're just trying to figure it out, man. Like, and so I see a similar thing with people in general. Most people are not equipped to handle their emotions in low-stakes situations, much less when you're in a situation like interfacing with law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
When law enforcement has a history everywhere of being a little trigger happy. So something has to give. Mm-hmm. You can give all of your emotion to the grit and the resilience and leave nothing for the regulation later. And I know we're kind of talking about both of these things, but the idea of regulation is a good idea, but a lot of times the situation is not set up for that
to
because
stay regulated.
Right, because most parties aren't even thinking that deeply. Most people don't think that deeply.
No.
I think people oftentimes interpret their emotions as a hill to climb, as opposed to a thing, a living, breathing thing that need be interfaced with. And I think that's the difference. If you're trying to regulate, you're realizing your emotions aren't the enemy.
Yes, I completely agree. And I think something that like ties into that really, really deeply is the limited number of emotions that white people are allowed to experience.
Mm.
The like white emotions are policed. And it's like this self-reinforcing system of like they police each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they police each other's emotions. And it's like, so there's this sort of like get in line attitude.
Right.
And what's really interesting, I love that you brought this up with the grit and resilience and then self-regulation. That's all like drawing from the same well.
Correct.
Right. So you're drawing like all of these things are coming from the same reservoir, which yes, you can like there are skills that you can learn to kind of pour into yourself, I guess. For, you know, I don't have really better language for that. But one, like, I love that you were talking about the like SEL coach, because there's nowhere in society to learn these things. There's nowhere safe and accessible in society to learn these things. You might be able to learn them in therapy. If you've got a therapist who's like oriented towards that, you know, which not all therapists are, and I don't think they all have to be necessarily, but I'm very stuck on this idea of like, we expect people to regulate. We expect people to have resilience. We give them no tools. We give them no safe places to practice these skills. Because again, it's not like an automatic, go do it, go be resilient. It's, you know, good on ya. It doesn't exist, right? And so it's like, you're supposed to be perfect at self-regulation, at resilience, with no skills, no training, no practice, no nothing, just like out into the world. And like within that, white people see social emotional learning as a threat.
Yes.
Right? It's why they're banning it from schools.
Amongst other things, but yes.
Amongst other things, right? And it's like, no, you can't teach my kid not to be selfish. No, you can't teach my kid not to hit. No, you can't teach my kid to take deep breaths. It's like, are you, that's what you're saying, right? But it's like, no, because there's like Marxist ideology. I'm like, hi, everything we know about the nervous system we've learned in the last like 25 years, Marx was not alive. So like, shut
Thank
up.
You.
Like, wasn't at all in the picture for Marx. So no, it has nothing to do with that.
Right.
It literally has to do with like brain scans. And like data, you know, if you're into the whole like facts don't care about your feelings thing, please stop invoking Marx in like studies that are 10 years old.
Right.
Not applicable. But it is really funny that they conflate the like learning to empathize with Marx, which I don't think that like Marx is like the ideal of human empathy.
I don't think so either.
I don't think he was trying to be.
No, no.
Like, maybe, like, I would say he was more trying to be a pragmatist than, like, an empath or whatever. But, like, the goal wasn't to, like, go, okay, here, like, his goal was not social-emotional learning.
Right.
His goal was not teaching white people compassion for people who don't look like them.
Right.
Okay? It was not.
There's something very utilitarian about Marxism.
Yes.
That does not engender the conversation of social emotional learning in any way. But I think that feeds in. The reason why they don't want it is because they associate that with liberalism.
Yes.
So they associate it with a political thing when it's as simple, and not to say that the personal isn't political, because it absolutely is.
Right. Yes.
But I mean, like, more broad strokes politics, like, oh, mm-hmm. that's the left. The left has feelings. You know, over here we have like meat and Scott Baio, you know, like it's very like in a box.
Yes.
And it's in a box, not because the box benefits me anyway, but uh-huh. because I've been wired to think that everything is taken away from me. Yeah. So do not tread on me or my box is essentially yeah. what it is.
Yeah. But what's interesting about that is that's not regulation either. Like they say, like, I'm going to come into this and I'm just going to be like this cool third party observer, like neutral. And it's like, well, no, you can't do that. So it's like, please stop lying to yourself. But also, I don't feel my feelings isn't neutrality. That's not objectivity.
No. And also, like, the idea of not feeling your feelings. Here's the thing. If you don't feel your feelings, somebody else is.
Yep.
If you're not dealing with it, it's going to deal with you and it's going to deal with everybody around you. And like, I had this own issue in my own life where there were like, I had been so inundated with situations where I couldn't feel my feelings
mm-hmm.
To right. where I ended up in the hospital at one point about 10 years ago. I went to the hospital twice for the same problem in the same day, to where I just started shaking and I couldn't, it was uncontrollable. And I was having an anxiety attack for the first time. Did not know what that was, because it was a thing that you saw talked about when they started making, like, about 20 years ago, when they started making long form commercials that they put on TV for like medicine. Like, that's when you started hearing about that stuff. But it wasn't something that I ever interfaced with personally
right.
until I had to.
Right.
Or when a partner tells you that they're doing more heavy lifting for your emotions than you are, and it's hurting them. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, this is ending up on somebody else.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean, so maybe I don't feel my feelings, but my feelings exist somewhere. They take up space. And mm-hmm. so this whole thing of like, I'm shutting myself off to all this stuff, which means I'm shutting the whole thing off.
Yeah.
No, your unwillingness, I guess, I don't know if this is a conversation about object permanence, but like your unwillingness to interpret the thing does not mean the thing is not available to interpret.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this idea of regulation is still like 2 and 3, maybe even 6 steps down the road for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Because the mm-hmm. idea of like feeling your emotions is buried behind a bunch of shit. Usually it's some variant or flavor of, well, back in my day, I'm not going to isolate certain generations when I say this, because I've heard people from all kinds of generations, even my generation, saying it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
yeah,
it's like back in my day, blah, 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 blah. We used to, I'm like, bro, we both got N64s for Christmas. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? Like, we had to roll up our sleeves, like, compared to what? Or yeah. when older generations say, like, you know, back in my day, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, back in your day, it was acceptable to give women blenders for Christmas. Back in your day, y'all had fake rocks for pets. Like, back in your day, like, the rules were just a different thing back in your day.
Yeah.
So what governance does that have now? Some of y'all's college tuition was free.
No, it wasn't, because that was Marxism.
Right, exactly. But that's the circular reasoning.
It's like, no, actually it was. Like, you paid $17.25 for that course. Like,
right.
It's like, well, I worked my way through school. It's like, because you could do that. And we knew right. less stuff, so there was less for you to study.
Like, it's just like, there's no, like, set aside the economy, like, your brain hasn't adjusted for inflation. Like, you know, like you still think Blossom is on Friday nights or whenever it came on. Like, you're still like 30 years behind the curve,
mm-hmm.
but you're trying to speak, but you're trying to speak to now as if a thing from back then still has any governance today, which is a yeah. shadow conversation about biblical literalism. But ultimately, like you were saying, regulation doesn't have a space because emotion. We still don't like it when babies cry on plane. We still look at mothers crazy if the baby has the nerve to feel big feelings in the grocery store.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't handle their emotions because you haven't even dealt with yours.
Yeah.
And that includes the good ones.
Yep.
I was 30 before I realized I liked things.
Mm-hmm.
And actually got to interface with what those things were.
Yeah.
Those are good emotions, but I was so numb to yeah. my emotions en masse that I didn't allow for the for the good things, much less the bad ones. Like, I think people are so scared of the bad emotions, they won't let them feel themselves feel the good ones.
Right.
And it's like, man, there's a whole swath of things you could feel that could unlock other things in your life, you know, if you have the grit and resilience to feel them. How about that?
Yeah, that's such a good point, right? It, for people for whom the expectation is grit and resilience, right? There is like thoughtlessness, I don't know, like, or ignorance around like kind of basic human needs.
Yeah.
What it looks like to stay alive as a person. And then like, I think on the flip side, there is the grit and resilience that is needed is like the ability to, yeah, like face your own emotional self.
Yeah.
And not run away from that. But there's nowhere for them to do that either. Like, that's not in the system either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? It's draining on everybody in different ways, right? And like, the impact is very different. And like, the quality of life is therefore quite different.
Yes.
But it's still a drain.
Absolutely. It's still a task.
Yes.
Like, you are, it's like, it's one thing to have societal mountains. Now you are like creating them. Like, now you are like giving yourself something to work around purely by the way you see something, not because it's an actual mountain in reality. It's because you just interpret it as such.
This is the mound of dirt upon which you have chosen to die. It's like, this is not a hill. And yet here you
That's
are.
That's a great point. Yes, exactly. And what's really hard is realizing the degree to which not dealing with those things have harmed other people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you realize, like, you, how long have you been feeling this from me and didn't feel like you could tell me? Because it's not like everybody's holding down on you sometimes. Sometimes the environment that is created by you being emotionally constipated is so toxic for me.
Mm-hmm.
There simply isn't any room for me to share this with you because I know what it is to regulate.
Right.
And sometimes regulating is not engaging the conversation until you are ready. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't know when you're going to be ready, which I think a lot of relationships fray and fall apart over time just because, not because people don't want to have that conversation, but they just don't know how to.
Yeah, I've been really stuck on this idea for the past several months. And I talked about this at Content Warning. I've been really stuck on this idea of like skills, tools, and opportunity, right? Because I don't believe in intelligence like as a construct. Like, I can kind of get what you're driving at when you're telling me like about IQ scores or someone being really good at something, right?
Sure.
But I don't think intelligence is linear in that way at all.
It absolutely isn't. Right. I agree.
And so show me, I don't want to see your grades until you control for like your skill set. So the skill set you were able to access growing up, the tools that you had access to growing up, and the opportunity that you had to practice those things. Because just because you have the skills and the tools handed to you doesn't mean you're given the opportunity to practice any of it.
Right.
Right. I think we see that a lot with like wealthy kids. And so I'm like, control for all of that and then tell me what your IQ is. And we know this to be true, like, you know, white evangelical missionaries and whatever. It's like, you can take a little like African kid out of Rwanda or Kenya or whatever and bring them to the States and like meet all of their needs and supply them with all of the support they need to be great at whatever it is they're going to do. And they're going to grow up to be like an attorney or a doctor or whatever they're going to get their MBA or whatever the thing. Like, it's literally just skills, tools, and opportunity, in my opinion.
Right.
There's a little bit of like the brain connectivity part that actually is somewhat volatile because that depends a lot on like your environment and like where you kept safe as a kid. But still, I think that when you control for those things, it's like intelligence isn't really very real.
No.
Like, the spectrum is much smaller when you have access to those things versus when you don't. You know, I think another way that I saw this sort of laid out was a data chart that was showing like the top 20% like highest performing schools and the lowest 20%. And it was interesting because there was, for poorer kids, there were schools that were performing really, really well that were like outliers. But for wealthy kids, there were no outliers. That was just the outcome you got. I think that when we're talking about grit and resilience, right? Just because you get a therapist when you're 9 years old, which, like, I think that that's a great thing to have if you have access to that, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be encouraged to use any skills that you might be given in that space. And you might not be given, like, really helpful tools in that space, like, that, because you don't have agency over, like, who your therapist is, really.
Right, exactly. Right?
Like, that's your parents' decision. And so I keep coming back to this idea of, like, what does it look like to give people, like, the space to learn these things? And we're not going to solve this right now, obviously. Like,
right,
this would
right.
be like fixing the whole world. But, like, what does it look like to give people a safe place, whatever, to practice these skills, right? Because they don't start out on autopilot. Like, you have to be able to practice them in situations in which they will be needed.
Right.
Without, like, fear or shame or punishment, without being called, like, compared to an animal, without, like, capitalism and white supremacy, basically.
Right.
Right? Like, that shame and fear and punishment based system. Like, and so for me, when I'm thinking about, like, grit and resilience and, like, what it looks like to kind of build up emotional regulation, and I have to do a shit ton of stuff to stay emotionally regulated.
Yeah.
And it's work for me to stay regulated. Like, it's exhausting. But also, if I don't do it, other people are impacted by that shit.
Right, right.
So it's not, like, my favorite thing to do. I don't love that, like, my day is just going to go way better if I sit down and meditate for 20 minutes. Like, can I just play, like, I don't know, Animal Crossing or some, I don't know. Like, can I just, like, play a game? I don't want to sit here and do nothing. I like the outcome, right?
Sure.
And so for me, the thing that I am really trying to tackle is, what are the skills and tools that we need? And then what does it look like to just, like, create opportunity? But I still think that, like, a lack of simple answers doesn't mean that, like, the goal isn't worth pursuing.
Right.
It's like, it's complicated and it's messy, but people are complicated and messy. So you're never going to get away from that. Even if you've got a system that supports you in providing you with skills and tools and opportunity and shame-free environments for you to learn, right? And so this is what I've been, like, trying to just sort of explore for the last several months, and probably for the next several months as well, I think, because, again, grit and resilience are skills that you can learn, right? Mm-hmm. If that's something that you need to do, like, we have data on this, we know that is the case. Regulation is a skill that, like, everyone should be required to learn.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, like, the number of wars that we fight just because, like, some dude couldn't regulate one time. Like, again, we're all punished for that shit.
Right.
We're all suffering because of that. As we're kind of, like, wrapping up, where for you personally were you able to kind of, like, create space or opportunity for that regulation piece of things? Because, mm-hmm. like you said at the beginning, the expectation is be resilient. Like, this is your lot in life. But obviously, like, you've been doing work to also get to a place where you have the self-regulation, which in turn does make resilience easier.
Yeah.
It doesn't fix the problem, right? Because the problems are systemic. But, like, so what did that journey look like for you?
Well, one of the fringe benefits of adoption trauma is people pleasing. And I say that jokingly, because people pleasing is actually a very destructive thing in my life, because it makes it very difficult to make decisions a lot of times. But one of the things it allows me to do is have to look at people closer. From my experience as an adoptee, I'm always reading the room because I don't want to rock the boat. Yeah. I don't want to be, like, there's something about being adopted that makes you feel like you're in rooms on a hall pass.
Yep.
Even if, like, you go to the same place every night. And so you're constantly reading rooms, you're constantly reading people and trying to get a fix on emotions, which is helpful and also kind of harmful.
Yeah.
It's helpful in the sense that you get a feel for different emotions, but it's harmful because you internalize a lot of that stuff. And it's very easy for you to feel like you are the cause of somebody's bad emotions, when in reality, like, people just be feeling stuff. And you can't really, you know, put all that on yourself, because they're walking into rooms with contexts that have nothing to do with you, the same way that you are walking into rooms with a context that they have no grid for. But what it taught me how to do is zoom out. And so as I was thinking about what it looks like to be present in a healthy way and to handle my emotions in a healthy way and to the greater purpose of regulation, it taught me to zoom out because my emotions are very, very, very intense. This is another thing with neurodivergence. I feel really strongly about the small stuff and I can handle the big stuff a lot easier. Yeah. I don't know why that is, but it's just kind of how I've functioned all my life. And so kind of by virtue of that weird polarity or whatever you want to call it, or my relationship to intensity, it allowed me to figure out how to zoom out and say, wait a minute, let's actually look at the situation as it is and not jump to conclusions about it. Like, what are the true things about these situations? What is true of you? And that can eventually lead to bigger questions about, will you care about this tomorrow? Does this have governance on over anything that occurs in the next 24 hours? If it doesn't, okay, then this is solvable. We just got to take it one step at a time. Do one thing at a time. It's like the way I look at relationships when I'm like partnered with someone. My big thing is like, I have a big, like, no yelling thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's very big for me.
Yeah.
Is like, if the conversation doesn't start with, I value you, then I'm not ready to have the conversation because I need to get back to that place of value. Really, for me, it starts with zooming out and saying, okay, what is true about this? What is true about me? And then isolating those things until I can figure that out. And then, okay, cool. How's that showing up on my body now? I've done a lot of hard things in my life. Nothing has been harder than learning how to relax my shoulders. Even now, I'm like, oh yeah, wait, that's just not like, wait, so that's not what I weigh? That's just like not healthy? Wow, that's new. So it's those little things, noticing things in my body, noticing how things show up. Like, it was only in the last couple of years that I noticed that I carry stress on my shoulders.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, okay, well, what does that look like to deal with that? How do I move forward? And I'm still figuring that out because I'm still getting used to, like, this is by no means a prescriptive list of things that I do.
Right.
Recognition of where, how things sit is, you know, has been helpful. CBD is wonderful for a city that has no idea how it feels about certain medicinal remedies. It exists in abundance in Atlanta. And so that helps in certain occasions. But yeah, somewhere along the line, it just kind of all those things created a composite where it's like, okay, this isn't a pre-existing plan, because I know that I could never stick to a pre-existing plan.
Right.
Because I've never been able to stick to a plan, literally to the point of having a planner in my entire life. So if this is going to work, I'm going to have to color outside the lines a little bit. It's finding what works for you and not judging yourself for that, because maybe it doesn't look like what this person or that person said it, but that person doesn't have your struggles. That person doesn't have your definition of grit or resilience. I know people who have gone through horrifying things within the context of relationship that have a very different relationship to resilience than I do. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, resilience and grit looks like my first understanding of family is abandonment. For me, grit and resilience is loving people well because I can and I have the ability to. What does it look like for you? You know, like that's the thing. So I feel like, you know, for me, it's recognizing it in my body, slowing down, taking that time where and when I can have it. And I recognize that's privileged for me, but privilege isn't necessarily inherently bad. It's how you use it, right? So taking the space, and in some cases, just, you know what, outright creating the space, saying, you know what, no. Like, I could grind here. I could push really hard here. And there would probably be some societal acceptance, you know, like I would be rewarded with that, with some kitschy thing at Hobby Lobby that reflects my experience. Or I could take that same space that I already have within the finite framework of existence and say, okay, I can calm down. I can do the things I know or am figuring out work for me and become a healthier human being for myself. And then the fringe benefit of that is that everybody else feels safer around me.
So good. No, I think that's awesome, because I think it is, it's kind of unique for everyone. And also, I think there are additional layers for neurodivergent folks. So I really appreciate you kind of sharing that part of it as well. Cause yeah, I think that it does looks very, very different for me too, because like the list of tasks that you have to accomplish is not getting done. Like, sorry.
Right.
Like that's not my calling. That's not my gift. Like,
so you figure out what you can do that day.
Exactly. Exactly. And that changes. And so you've got to just be willing to like flex with it, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
Benji, thank you so much for coming on. Hopefully we will hear from you more in the future, if you have any interest in coming back on the show.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me. This is fun.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Can you tell people where to find all of your wonderful stuff?
Oh yeah. See, this online is the part I'm terrible at. You can find me. Mostly I am on Instagram. I am not great at the other ones, but mainly because Instagram has been the kind of the place where most people find me. But you can find me on Instagram at Hey There Benji. I believe you can find me on TikTok there. I haven't posted on TikTok in like 6 months. And you can also find me on the artist formerly known as Twitter with the hashtag @_ Hey There Benji, because apparently Hey There Benji was taken. I think that's all the places I show up. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much again.
Yeah.
Appreciate you
for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for taking the time to educate yourself with this episode. If you have thoughts or an idea for a show episode, you can shoot me an email at hello@toriglass.com. If you want free anti-racism tools, you can find those at toriglass.com as well. This show is only possible because of a cadre of fiercely committed patrons. If you want to help us create a more just world, you can pledge support at www.whitehomework.com. Write a 5-star review and text this episode to a friend. Until next time, keep drinking water and fighting racism.